Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the oldest known recordings of Yiddish music are housed here in Wisconsin, and they're now a part of the National Recording Registry. We'll find out about the history of the recordings and how they came to the state. First, asylum seekers coming to the United States would have been sent to so-called sanctuary cities under a plan proposed to immigration officials by the White House. This plan was first reported by the Washington Post and confirmed on Twitter by President Trump himself. The move was largely seen as political retaliation against Democrats in Congress, including House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. And the president seemed to echo this sentiment in a series of tweets criticizing Democrats for their stance on immigration. Though there are currently no concrete plans to make good on the president's wish, the proposal did highlight the ongoing political and human issues surrounding immigration in the United States. Elise Cohen is an assistant professor of political science at UW Green Bay. Elise, welcome back to Central Time.
Great to be with you, Rob.
Well, again, Elise, this is a plan that, at least as of now, looks like it's not happening. But what do you make of the politics behind it and the attitude toward immigration behind the White House apparently pushing this idea?
Yeah, those are some great questions animating this proposal. We know this is the third time in the past 6 months that President Trump has proposed something like this. So clearly we see this is really important to the administration, but they are trying to find a legal way to figure out how detained undocumented migrants can be perhaps bused, is some of the words we've seen in President Trump's tweets, or transported to what he calls sanctuary cities. You're absolutely right that we have to think of this in the context of the upcoming 2020 presidential elections. There's so much going on in terms of the politics. On one hand, this points to the liberals or Democrats somehow harboring dangerous illegal aliens, and it's a great opportunity for the narrative that portrays these big metropolitan areas that harbor undocumented immigrants or somehow shield or protect them to be threatening America's safety. On the other hand, it then plays into Democratic and liberal ideological language that says we welcome diversity and we welcome immigrants even if they are unauthorized. So it really does give us a lot to work with in terms of analyzing the partisan conflict here.
Let's talk about what we mean by sanctuary city, or in some cases counties or other units of government. There's not really one set legal definition of that, right?
You're absolutely right. It is not an official term. It's not a legal term. In fact, the exact number of how many sanctuary cities there are in the United States varies depending on whether you look at counties that refuse to cooperate with what are called ICE detainers, where ICE would request that a local jail hold an unauthorized immigrant for maybe 48 hours so that they can then come in and pick them up. And so some of those jurisdictions might refuse to cooperate with ICE detainers, and that would be one way of measuring it. But there are others that may perhaps have passed ordinances at the city level or like an entire state like California that might pass a state law saying we hereby are not going to cooperate with federal immigration authorities in local law enforcement matters. So you're right, there's no set legal term and the number of them is hard to kind of pin down.
And there's some wiggle room. At least some of the ordinances I've looked at specify what you just said, a local community wouldn't cooperate with ICE, with some exceptions. In case of someone who commits a violent felony, someone who's a member of a gang on a terrorist watch list, in those cases, at least some of these communities would have an exception to that so-called sanctuary status.
You're absolutely right. And another thing to keep in mind is even though they're popularly termed sanctuary cities or jurisdictions, there's no true way to offer sanctuary to unauthorized or undocumented immigrants because the federal reach of ICE is just that. It's federal. So even in places like San Francisco or Los Angeles or Chicago, we absolutely see ICE can still conduct operations and raids. And you're also right that if somebody is committing a crime, whether they're undocumented or a citizen, those states and those jurisdictions would still prosecute them to the full extent of the law for those crimes.
Here in Wisconsin, what communities would fit in at least some ways into that sanctuary designation?
Yeah, the Sanctuary City has a really interesting history. It goes way back, some would say, to the Fugitive Slave Act, when some of the earliest sanctuary jurisdictions refused to cooperate with federal law. And in the 1980s is where we see the more common usage of what is today called the Sanctuary City regarding federal law on immigration and local authorities not wanting to cooperate with deportation orders. And Madison is one of those. The start of them actually took place more in the California area, Los Angeles, San Francisco, during the 1980s when we saw refugees and asylum seekers from Central America. And so California really led the way. But we do have areas in the Midwest, in Illinois, Iowa, like I said, in Madison, that have also have some of those ordinances where they will not cooperate with ICE detainers' requests.
Talking to Elise Cohen, assistant professor of political science at UW Green Bay, about the president and others in the White House trying to enact a policy where asylum seekers could be transported to so-called sanctuary cities around the country. Elise, what do we know about the legal framework of how this would work? Is this something that the White House could do, and how would that be put into place?
The legality is probably the biggest hurdle for the Trump administration. As I mentioned at the start of our program, this is the third time the administration has tried this or proposed this. So what we can imagine is there must be some legal hurdles that the Department of Homeland Security is anticipating in sort of telling his administration or his White House officials, no, we can't really do this. The biggest one appears to be the separation of powers issue, where Congress is responsible for the allocation of the funding to the Department of Homeland Security, and it has sort of earmarked or, you know, designated that funding in a very specific way, what it can and cannot be used for, and there's nothing in that legislation that says it can be used to transport detainees internally between states to go to more liberal or Democratic-controlled, what we would call sanctuary cities. So that's probably the number one hurdle, would just be the separation of powers, that the executive branch couldn't sort of overstep the authority of Congress regarding how it has designated monies.
Now, underlying all this is a core problem. We've seen an increase, at least in the standards of recent years, in the number of people coming up from Central America, crossing the border, whether at points of entry or non-legal points of entry, many claiming asylum status, which gives them certain legal protections. And lots of people and no clear idea of where the United States government should put them. What's the current situation like?
Yeah, you're absolutely right that this is different from the past, because we see almost an unprecedented number of the people that are entering the country without papers, without documentation, are families, and they are making asylum requests, meaning that they are claiming to fear persecution, political persecution, harm, or torture in their country of origin. Whereas in the past, a lot of those border apprehensions for unauthorized entry were maybe, you know, adult males from Mexico. We see a lot of the current group of people are families or unaccompanied minor children, many women, and rather than Mexico, they are coming from those Central American countries that are facing high levels of violence, gang violence, and other types of political violence. So it's very difficult because our system is not set up to harbor families and children, and there are specific laws that govern even how long children and families can be detained, something the Trump administration has been very frustrated with in the past, and has tried in legal battles to fight and has not been successfully able to do so.
Do you see possible solutions? Assuming that people keep coming up from Central America, what kind of options are there for the United States?
So currently, for many of these families, they may try and release them into shelters, or in some cases, they may release them just at bus depots, areas in the community, and hope that local shelters or NGOs will respond to them. Another thing that is an option is to release them and have a monitoring as they await their immigration court date. What we're hearing from some of those officials is that they're kind of overwhelmed in terms of not having enough equipment for the monitoring, in addition to not having enough locations. many advocates for human rights or for migrant rights would say they should be released, they should not be detained, and international law really discourages the detention of asylum seekers anyways. So in some ways, you know, releasing them as they await their court trial date is what those advocates would say the government should be doing anyway. The concern for the Trump administration and many supporters, many Republicans, for example, would say that they fear those people are making fraudulent claims or would somehow be a public safety threat if they are not detained.
You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we continue our conversation about President Trump's proposal to send asylum seekers to sanctuary cities and the pushback from Democratic lawmakers. That plan, as of right now, doesn't seem to be going anywhere. Our guest is Elise Cohen, Assistant Professor of Political Science at UW-Green Bay. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of this idea from the president of moving asylum seekers to be released into these so-called sanctuary cities? What do you think about the idea of sanctuary cities, communities that in one way or another don't completely work with federal immigration enforcement? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll go to your calls now. Willem is with us in Colfax. Willem, hi.
Hi. I think that this really isn't about immigration policy or asylum seekers. I don't think it has anything to do with that. He, as in his usual fashion, is just trying to stick it to people that he perceives to be his political opponents, people who are in favor of humane treatment to asylum seekers and have asylum cities. And I think that the only reason that he's doing this is just to kind of be a jerk in his, you know, in his usual fashion. I think this man doesn't realize that he, when he speaks, he's speaking as the President of the United States, and I think he does a disservice to our country, to the ideals of the Statue of Liberty, or even to the Christian value where Christ says, what you do the least of these, you do unto me, and it doesn't get any plainer than that. So,
Willem, thanks a lot for the call. Elise, you were touching a little bit earlier about the president framing the conversation here, and the president, whether you like him or not, definitely wants people talking and thinking about immigration and illegal immigration. He thinks it's a winning issue for him and for Republicans. Do you see it through that lens?
Absolutely. There's a few concepts from political science that I think are really helpful for understanding what your caller was asking about there, how this may just be a political move. You know, for one angle, we can look at the urban versus rural divide, and we could see it aligns really nicely with the narrative that these sanctuary cities are harboring illegal criminal aliens that are making our country less safe. And we also know that rural America is painted in oftentimes Republican narratives as a more real America, and then these large city centers and urban areas are painted as sort of liberal bubbles. And President Trump himself, you know, has used radical left in his recent tweets on the issue, describing who manages these cities. And if you look at even some of the responses and support of those tweets, and you look at the comments, you can see many say, right, well, these liberal bubble city centers are just piles of garbage, so they deserve to have these people dumped in them. So it's kind of playing into that urban-rural narrative really nicely to focus on targeting certain big cities. The other side of it that we can see tying in nicely with political science concepts is affective polarization, which really just means having positive feelings towards members of your own political party and negative feelings towards members of the opposing political party. And that's what we can see also in some of the rhetoric about how it is good to stick it to them, which I think is kind of the language your caller used there. Stick it to the enemy, stick it to the opponent. Those liberals and those Democrats in those big cities that claim they welcome migrants, well, let's really stick it to them, so to speak, by giving them all of these thousands of people and forcing them to manage or deal with the burden they presume that those people will bring.
Do we know much about levels of crime and public safety in cities that have large communities of immigrants, illegal immigrants, or in sanctuary cities?
Yes, we do have a lot of empirical research, a lot of evidence and studies that have been done tracking the claim that immigrants may be correlated, undocumented immigrants, that is, may be correlated with higher crime. And what we found is that those correlations unravel when we start to look into those studies. In some cases, studies will even find the absolute opposite conclusion, that communities that have higher levels of immigrants undocumented, for example, will have lower levels of crime because those people are more afraid of somehow being caught up in the law enforcement system. But we have not been able to find studies that really across the board show us that there's higher crime.
Let's go back to our callers now. Mary Kay is with us in Kenosha. Mary Kay, hi.
Hi. I look at this as a civil rights issue for the 14th Amendment in our Bill of Rights. And our Congress should be dealing with the policy of immigration, or they should be fired. I'm not kidding. Okay? Because we are a sovereign nation. We shouldn't have open borders as we do. States shouldn't be harboring people that have not had their shots or have no papers. So, again, I blame the Congress. They're supposed to be dealing with this issue.
Mary Kay, thanks for the call. Mary Kay, worried, as President Trump and others are, about the idea of open borders, Elise.
Yeah, and open borders is some of the rhetoric we've seen used as a partisan tool, a partisan weapon in this debate. It's, again, part of the Republican narrative to say that the Democrats support open borders, no border patrol. We see some Democrats say, well, that's an unfair overgeneralization, but we do see some Democrats that say, well, maybe there should be a movement to abolish ICE or something of that nature. So Democrats don't really have a unified message regarding plans of what to do, but more of a message that's against what the Republican rhetoric is. And I think the point your caller brings up about, you know, should states be allowed to do this? That's one that goes back to our history in terms of our federalism and our sharing of power between states and the federal government. What's really interesting when you look at the Supreme Court ruling that has upheld sanctuary cities being allowed to sort of have local law enforcement not be forced to cooperate with federal immigration, is those rulings from the Supreme Court oftentimes have been in favor of conservative causes, where there was a concern among Republicans and conservatives the federal government was overreaching on something like requiring local law enforcement to do gun bill background checks, for example, or the latest one under the Obama administration, forcing states to expand who qualifies for Medicaid. And those are the same logics which also justify local authorities not being forced or compelled to cooperate with federal immigration. It's sort of this idea of states' rights and states being able to have their own autonomy.
Talking to Elise Cohen, assistant professor of political science at UW Green Bay, looking at immigration policy in the United States and President Trump's calls to transport asylum seekers from the border to sanctuary cities around the country. Back to your calls now. Ron is with us in Norwalk. Ron, hello.
Hi. Good afternoon, Rob. I think she just answered my comment or question. Is it's ironic that the Republicans who are all for states' rights, when they actually start exercising those rights, in this case with sanctuary cities, then they're all up in arms. I just find that not consistent. But that's my comment. Thank you,
Ron. Thanks for the call. And Elise, big picture, this goes way back, as you were saying, the conflict between local or state governments when their priorities run afoul of federal law and enforcement.
Yes, the principle that your caller is kind of tapping into with the states' rights in terms of how it relates is called the anti-commandeering doctrine, and it's something that the Supreme Court has upheld over several rulings going back to the mid-1800s. The first big one, which I think I mentioned earlier in the program regarding the Fugitive Slave Act, it's kind of an interesting parallel to consider. Local areas that did not want to be forced to cooperate with the federal law of returning those slaves back to the slave-owning states. We're also sort of using the states' rights idea or local autonomy idea. And in 1842, the Supreme Court upheld that and said that Congress has the responsibility of enforcing federal law. Federal officials can't make local officials take on the burden or the resources or the means of enforcing what is a federal responsibility, not a local responsibility.
Didn't the Dred Scott decision kind of run against that idea, though?
Yeah, so we also have this idea that federal law is supreme, and so it's one of those very murky areas where we see a lot of debate. Even many of these Supreme Court rulings that I'm mentioning now were not unanimous, and some of the justices thought, well, no, this is an issue where federal law trumps state law, and so perhaps the states or local authorities should be compelled to cooperate. But in the cases that we've seen, about four Supreme Court cases that all revolve around similar issues of local law enforcement being kind of forced to use their resources to help federal enforcement agencies, the justices in the majority have said it was going a little bit too far, and it was actually compelling states to do something that should be only done by Congress and by federal law enforcement.
Elise, in our last couple of minutes, our caller Mary Kay earlier mentioned Congress not getting anything done, and that seems like to be the key theme in immigration policy in the United States. This is so divided in Congress. Congress is the body with the most authority, probably to change things here. Yet they're not getting anything done. Do you see any sign or hope that that might change?
Unfortunately, it seems like the probability of having a comprehensive immigration reform bill that can pass through both chambers, as would be required in Congress to become law, has really gone down because the issue has become even more polarized than it was perhaps 10 years ago. And in part, that does play nicely into the president saying, well, then I need to take executive action or, you know, advise agencies to do something that isn't usual or isn't normal because Congress isn't doing its job. But I think in a lot of ways, when we look at the narratives, that's really where we see that this is something, if your opponent is for it, then you must be against it. So if your opponent wants to welcome a certain category of unauthorized immigrant, then maybe you must be, against welcoming them, and vice versa.
We'll leave it there for now. Elise, thanks again for joining us today.
Great to be with you.
Elise Cohen is an assistant professor of political science at UW-Green Bay. She joins us today to talk about immigration and asylum seekers after news of the White House proposal to relocate asylum seekers to so-called sanctuary cities. The president has tweeted that that is, in fact, something he has sought after, but there are no current plans in the works to do that. Coming up after the news, we'll find out about the oldest known recordings of Yiddish music that are being preserved here in Wisconsin. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to The Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. The National Recording Registry, part of the Library of Congress, chooses a new group of audio recordings every year that are deemed historic and worthy of preservation. This year's class includes an album by Cyndi Lauper, a speech from Bobby Kennedy, and the earliest known recordings of Yiddish music. The wax cylinders holding these Yiddish songs are housed here in Wisconsin on the UW-Madison campus. They're part of a larger collection of over 9,000 recordings capturing a wide range of the Jewish music tradition. Tom Kaw is the Music Public Services Librarian at Mills Music Library at UW-Madison. Tom, thanks a lot for coming up.
Thank you for having me.
Well, tell us about the origin of these cylinders. How were they created?
Well, these cylinder recordings were made in, we think the best guess is 1901 to 1903, recorded in New York City, actually by the Standard Phonograph Company. They were initially thought to be Lambert Company, issued them in Chicago. They were thought to be Lambert. That's how they came to be known as the Lambert Yiddish Cylinders. But they were recorded in New York, it turns out.
And these are recorded onto wax cylinders, which
correct.
I think of as the Thomas Edison kind of recording.
Correct.
Talk about that technology a little.
Correct. Well, it's fascinating technology that didn't stick around too long, because in all these audio engineering developments, things changed rapidly at the end of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th century. So, yeah, I mean, Edison, there's actually some notes that I have in front of me about how Thomas Lambert created the first molded celluloid cylinders, but he's remembered largely for these garish multi-hued shadings of the ones he did. He made pink ones. So some of the ones we have are pink cylinders. They're very lovely to look at. We have photos online, but Yeah, they were, Thomas Edison initially got so jealous of Lambert and his technology, he drove him out of business through a series of lawsuits.
Wow. Now, tell us what is on these cylinders. We're going to take a quick listen in a minute, but
right.
What is compiled on these cylinders?
All right. Well, on the Lambert, I'll just call them the Lambert cylinders for shorthand. On the Lambert cylinders that we have at Mills Music Library, there are a variety of types of music. There are Yiddish operatic arias, cantorial hymns, some folk songs, some broadside ballads, the kind of things that some people might have sung on street corners based on topical themes of the day.
Let's give a listen to a verse of one of these recordings.
Viele Männer lieben mir, viele hot ich hatte ich, junge Herzlach fallen so wie Streit, Helden fallen auf die Knie.
Now, this isn't what we'd think of as modern quality sound, but I gotta say, from the medium, from the age,
right.
It sounds pretty good.
Yeah, it does. The technology is phenomenal for doing digital transfers, restoration work on these recordings. So, yeah, it is amazing how good the quality can be.
What does it take to preserve these wax cylinders? Are these a fragile medium that's hard to keep around?
Oh, yes. they need to be, well, they first of all are kept in cases, and then those cases we have in boxes. We have our cylinders housed at Mills Music Library, which is located in the basement of Memorial Library on campus. But yeah, the initial transfer of those these cylinders was done by collector historian David Giovannoni, and then the initial transfer was then cleaned up by Richard Martin of Archaeophone Records, who we partnered with to release digitized versions of them on the CD Attractive Hebrews.
Right. We played the digitized version. We
Correct.
Do not have a wax
right.
cylinder player
right.
here at Wisconsin.
We're not playing from the actual cylinder here.
Talking to Tom Cobb, Music Public Services Librarian at Mills Music Library at UW-Madison, about some of the newest entries in the National Recording Registry, wax cylinders containing Yiddish songs from over 100 years ago. They're housed at UW-Madison. All right, we talked about the technological significance here. How about the cultural significance of the recordings on these cylinders?
Yes, well, they are significant in that they are the earliest, among the earliest known recordings of Yiddish language music. And as I said before, they're most likely done between 1901 and 1903 in New York City. Yeah, David Giovannoni has spent 30 years trying to track them down, and Henry Sapoznik, the former director of the Mayrin Institute for the Study of Yiddish Culture here, he connected with Giovannoni. He brought them to the attention of his friend Sherry Mayrent, who is the collector who established the Mayrent Collection of Yiddish Recordings, which is the 9,000-plus 78 RPM records that she had initially donated to us at Mills in 2010. So Henry got Sherry aware. She acquired the cylinders to be part of the Mayrent collection. So, I mean, it's just really significant to preserve this moment, this slice of history of immigrant culture, especially in New York City, of Eastern European, primarily Ashkenazic Jews in the city.
And part of the significance of the existence of these recordings is, you know, if I was a music publisher, producer at the time, ethnic music might not be my first choice for commercial success. So this makes this a bit more rare, right?
Right. It might not be what you would think of as the top of the hit parade, mm-hmm. say, but every company, both sheet music publishers, record companies, they were all trying to find their niche markets. And so the people from whom they drew the talent here, from the Yiddish theater, from the synagogues, from the cantorial tradition, they were coming out of this immigrant population the companies knew they could sell and market back to the immigrant population, both in New York City and then beyond, because there were other immigrant communities in other cities in the United States.
And we've talked on the show to some of UW's ethnomusicologists and folk music historians. This has got to be, these recordings and the others have got to be a treasure trove for people in that line.
Oh, definitely. Definitely so. And it's been amazing here on our campus. As a librarian, I do instruction to help students learn how to do research in the library. There's a course that Professor Pamela Potter teaches called Yiddish Song and the Jewish Experience. And these resources are incredible to give students this entree into this world from the late 19th century through the middle of the 20th century.
Now tell us more about the collection. These are part of mostly 78 records.
Right.
What kind of, give us a sense of the range that that includes.
Oh my, it's all over the place. Sometimes it's actually, again, a lot of theater music from the Yiddish theater tradition. Some of it is, straight cantorial hymns. There are a lot of spoken comedy routines, things that came out of the theater, came out of vaudeville. I'm thinking of Abe Kabibble at the ball game, a story about a guy going to his first baseball game and trying to describe it. It's all over the place. And the time span of Sherry Mayrant's collection goes from roughly 1895 to 1955. So it goes a long way, and it goes in depth, and we have digitized these as part of our preservation effort and put them up online. People may access them freely. All of these cylinder recordings now, along with images of them, are on the University of Wisconsin-Madison Library's digital collections site. It's easily findable via Google.
And you mentioned it, this came from her collection. Why did it come here?
It's a good story. Henry Sapoznik came as a visiting artist in residence. He thought, my friend Sherry has this amazing collection. Maybe she's looking for some institutional home for it. He put her in touch with us. We talked. There were a lot of talks, a lot of documents drawn up, and she agreed to donate the collection and then set up the Mayrant Institute for Yiddish Culture as well, so that the work could be done to preserve this, put it all in context. Henry Sapoznik directed it. Scott Carter was the former assistant director. He did a lot of research on this as well, looking up all the information about the Lambert Company and getting more information for the Attractive Hebrews CD set that Archaeophone Records put out in 2016. So, it's just been a great relationship with Sherry Mayrant all along.
And as we wrap up now, as we said, these cylinders of Yiddish music from over 100 years ago, now part of the National Recording Registry. What does that mean for them?
That means that's amazing to us, because we have already done our work of preserving them. We've found value in them, of course, and now the Library of Congress has deemed them valuable enough to the nation's recorded history of sound that they are going to preserve them there as well. So lots of copies keep things safe in our world, and the fact that the Library of Congress is going to preserve them as well means more people will have access to them in perpetuity.
Thanks a lot for joining us today.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Tom Kaws, the Music Public Services Librarian at Mills Music Library at UW-Madison. He was with us to talk about the library's recordings of early Yiddish music that recently got welcomed into the National Recording Registry. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Foxconn announced last week that it's planning to buy a building in downtown Madison directly across from the Capitol. The company says the six-story building will be used for another innovation center. In the past year, Foxconn has pledged to open hubs in Green Bay, Eau Claire, Milwaukee, and Racine. So what's been happening with these centers? According to a new report in The Verge, not much. It says most of the buildings are empty, that in some cases they haven't been purchased, and that nobody seems to know what's going on. In response, Foxconn says, don't believe everything you read. Nick Williams covers technology, residential real estate, and transportation for the Milwaukee Business Journal. Nick, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Nick, these innovation centers, a lot of them were announced last year. We're hearing about more of them. What, according to Foxconn, are these going to be? What are they going to do?
So according to Foxconn, what these innovation centers are going to be for is where researchers working for Foxconn are going to work on artificial intelligence, fifth-generation cellular use, and 8K, which is 8,000 pixel pixelation for screens. Now, the new building in Madison, from what we've reported, is going to be primarily working on health and data science in partnership with UW-Madison. As part of that $100 million investment that Foxconn made to the university last year.
And these innovation centers weren't part of the original plan. It was announced that Foxconn was coming to Wisconsin, right? This came later.
I think this is part of their, I want to say outreach, but as part of like the Foxconn effect. They understand that in order to fulfill what they want to do here in Wisconsin, they're going to need a strong pipeline of talent. And if you talk to anybody in business around here, there's a massive shortage of tech talent. So I think what Foxconn has done has been very strategic about where they want to pull talent from, right? And think about it, every center is near a university. So, you know, Racine, Madison, Milwaukee, now Madison, all near college campuses. So their point is to draw and attract talent directly from the schools. So this is like their, you know, forward-looking strategy for constantly pumping talent into their operation here.
Now, all along, there's been some skepticism about the main Foxconn plant. Foxconn has altered plans a couple times. Some people are wondering if it's going to be as big as they promised. Are we seeing similar kinds of worries about these innovation centers and what the final product is going to be?
You know, I haven't heard anybody worrying about it. We actually had a panel discussion with local CEOs about Foxconn this morning. And Foxconn is all about partnerships with these innovation centers. They're, in addition to the 100 to 200 employees from Foxconn in each center, they're also planning to have, some student lab work go through there, partnerships with other companies and other startups that Foxconn or their partners might invest in. So it's not just going to be Foxconn employees. It's going to be this, you know, tech hub, if you will, within a building where, say, a company wants to send some of their software people to work in that building just so they can be in that environment. That's what Foxconn is open to, according to the person that spoke in Green Bay. And also, Foxconn, Northwestern Mutual, Johnson Controls, Aurora are combining on this $100 million venture capital fund. And the startups that are invested in, you know, this is going to be like an international fund. Those companies, if they come here or choose to relocate here, will have space inside of those buildings. They've also talked about running some type of incubator or accelerator programs out of these innovation centers. So it's not just what Foxconn's working on. It's what they're working on with their partners, what students are going to work on, what other companies are going to work on with Foxconn, what startup companies are going to work on in there. It's like a huge research hub. So it's beyond, just Foxconn manufacturing electrical products.
Talking to Nick Williams from the Milwaukee Business Journal. He covers technology, residential real estate, and transportation. Looking at the latest with Foxconn developments, various innovation hubs they have planned for communities around the state. Nick, you mentioned that talk in Green Bay. You reported on that. What are some of the specific things that Foxconn and their partners are talking about when it comes to Green Bay?
So in Green Bay, partnership with UW-Green Bay and another college up there, the name escapes me right now. So their plan is to have students using this lab, this space to work on, disruptive technologies. Now, it wasn't said, specifically, but the representative said, it's intriguing that Microsoft and the Packers are working on this Titletown Tech initiative in Green Bay, and there's possibilities there of Foxconn, the Packers, and Microsoft working on some type of partnership in that area. But mainly, the Green Bay office was a pipeline for students there, for partnerships with the companies there, and being Green Bay, the largest, third largest city in Wisconsin, it made sense for them to have a presence there.
Did Foxconn give timelines when these innovation hubs would be up and running?
They did not. what was talked about is they're still developing the building. I know most of these the sales closed recently for these buildings, and they have to go in there. I would assume to renovate it to what they want it to be, and then set up, you know, lab spaces, co-working spaces. If a company wants to rent out a suite there or something like that, that has to be determined. So no timeline on when these innovation centers will be operational.
And we mentioned that report in the online magazine The Verge, where a reporter looked and saw not a lot going on at the hubs so far. Foxconn responded to that, saying that there were inaccuracies in the report, that they'd be issuing corrections soon. Are they giving a lot of specific details on any part of these plans, or do things seem kind of vague and changing at this point?
I would say in regards to Green Bay and Eau Claire, that seems upon what they were saying all along. That's going to be a research innovation center. Now, Racine is going to be used more to work on their smart city initiatives. So that is something that's being developed. You know, Racine and Foxconn have this partnership together to make Racine a smart city. And, of course, Foxconn has this $1 million smart city competition. So there is development within the Racine office of what's going to be done throughout there. Now, the Milwaukee North American headquarters, I haven't seen anything recently on what's going to be base out of there or what type of R&D will happen there. But as far as Racine goes, that has been a development that they're working with Racine to make Racine a smart city, and that the Smart Cities competition, you know, is being facilitated through that office.
And I wanted to ask about the Racine, the smart city project there. What do they mean by that? What kind of things would go into a smart city?
Well, with a smart city, you're talking about connectivity and how transit is being more, built more efficiently, how connected systems could be used for traffic lights, sensors for traffic lights, and safety at intersections. You can also incorporate a smart city in using just smart energy usage, renewable energy systems, things of that nature, smart wastewater management systems, ways that you could use your smartphone to connect with parking systems or to unlock certain systems, smart transit, as far as everything has to be where you're going to park, a smart system of parking cars in public spaces. Those are the type of initiatives that college students and faculty who are part of the competition are working on.
And finally, just in our last less than a minute, Nick, what is the latest on the main site, the Pleasant Prairie Foxconn development?
Oh, you mean Mount Pleasant?
Mount Pleasant. I'm sorry. Yes.
Yeah. So as far as we've heard, they're I guess the I apologize if I'm getting this incorrect, but I think there are RFPs out for the foundation of the for who's going to build the foundation of the LCD plant. In Mount Pleasant, they're putting out, requests for proposals for that. And also, Wisconsin Valley Way, the main road leading to the facility, is starting construction, I think, this week. Those are the latest developments we've heard within the last week regarding the Mount Pleasant site.
We'll leave it there for now. Nick, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's Nick Williams, technology, housing, and transit reporter for the Milwaukee Business Journal. He joined us to look at Foxconn plans for these innovation centers around the state. That includes Green Bay, Eau Claire, Madison, Milwaukee, and Racine, and the latest developments at those, and a quick check-in on the main site there in Mount Pleasant. You can share your observations if you are in one of those communities, if you work near one of the sites with a Foxconn sign on it. What are you seeing? What's going on there? Are you excited about it or worried about it? You can email ideas@WPR.org or tweet us @CentralTimeWPR and let us know what's going on. Last month, a young Brewers fan caught the attention of the baseball world with a sign that read, "Yelich hit a home run and Dad buys me a puppy." Christian Yelich delivered the home run, and this week it looks like he delivered the puppy too. Then a few more home runs. Bill Martins is here. What's going on here, Bill?
Okay, so earlier in the season, this family went to a Brewer game. It was mom and dad and their two young girls. And the girl, as you mentioned, had this sign, "Yelich hit a home run and I get a puppy." And he hit the home run. And this picture was tweeted. There were news stories about it. No way Dad was getting out of not buying this dog at this point, right? And so the Brewers found out who this family was. They reached out to them and they arranged a meeting yesterday, secret to the kids. And I'm getting all this from the Journal Sentinel, by the way. So they show up to batting practice yesterday, and who comes walking out but Christian Yelich? And he's got this mini doodle, and he presents it to the girl, and he posed for pictures and signed the sign, and it was a good story.
Right. Now, if my kids are listening, and they're not, no number of home runs will get you a puppy. It's just not going to happen.
Right.
But Christian Yelich, now, apparently he was inspired by this. Right? He had an okay outing?
Oh, yeah. He hit three homers, and he drove in seven runs, and Brewers beat the Cardinals, so okay. I like that part of it.
And this one of the kids in this family has diabetes. There's some hope that they can train this dog to be, this is a thing, a diabetes-sniffing dog.
Yeah, there are certain dogs that can, I guess, detect blood sugar levels on someone's breath, and so they're hoping it can help this girl out.
It's a home run all around. Thanks, Bill. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.